In the coming week, Russian and Belarusian leaders hold integration talks. Germany's election season ramps up, and the United States and Mexico hold high-level economic talks. It's September 2nd, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, in the coming week, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko are set to meet to discuss their country's bilateral agenda. The talks are scheduled to begin next Thursday, September 9th. Can you tell us what the two leaders are going to be talking about in particular, Bob?
Sure, Jim. It seems to be an intensification of the so-called integration process between Russia and Belarus. This is something I should note that goes back decades. At least 20 years or so, there have been talks sort of formally directed towards integration. It goes back even earlier to the actual disintegration of the Soviet Union, even when that became a notion. But they do seem to have been picking away at a number of issues and might be coming close to finalizing two rather big ones in time for somehow formally anointing an integration process even this fall. At least that's what is being discussed. First of all, I'll say what's behind this and then talk a little bit about what integration is. What's behind it is I think, as we saw at the early summer talks between the two, Belarus is more and more isolated in the rest of the world, in part because of its harsh crackdown and its behavior as part of that, including skyjacking a plane that had a noted opposition figure on board. And that person is now has been in custody. And using migrants in a sort of a weaponized fashion to put pressure on neighbors Lithuania and Poland. And so Russia is a sort of a safe harbor country for Belarus. The two countries have had longstanding ties, although the two longstanding leaders, by many accounts, are not really fond of each other. But they are talking about as many as 28 integration roadmaps. There's two items in particular that they'll be talking about, or they're expected to talk about next week, Jim, including harmonization of customs and tax legislation, and then some kind of a merger of the Belarusian and Russian energy market. Those are pretty big issues, and there's a reason why there have been sticking points. The energy one in particular is interesting because the Belarusian side wants lower energy prices. Russia's close to getting its Nord Stream 2 pipeline online that'll send natural gas to Europe bypassing Ukraine. So there's a lot of things happening on the energy front. And then finally, I would say, Jim, that they're also going to be talking ahead of some major military exercises the two sides are going to be holding that are in the Black Sea region. And there's been talk about Russia providing Belarus with new military capabilities, including aircraft and air defense systems. So there's a lot on the agenda here, and it's happening at a time when both countries are feeling antagonistic and antagonized by the West.
Bob, what's driving these talks, given, as you noted, Putin and Lukashenko don't necessarily like each other, and the Belarusians for many decades now have resisted efforts by the Kremlin to draw them closer to Russia?
It's a great question, Jim. And Lukashenko has, ironically, pinned a lot of his popularity in the past on his assertion of Belarusian sovereignty, of being a distinct country, not, while certainly close to Russia, a number of ways, its own place. But I think it really is this sense of victimization, certainly on the Belarusian side, that under sanctions and under tightening pressure from, Western European countries and the U.S., because of its really harsh crackdown on the opposition that had been protesting the elections from a year ago, which basically Lukashenko hijacked the election results, and then crack down on the leading opposition figures. So it's that sense of victimization. And then Russia remains under sanctions for a variety of things, including its moves against its own main opposition opponent, Alexei Navalny, who remains in detention, including its ongoing occupation of Crimea, which it annexed 7 years ago, and its actions in support of separatists in eastern Ukraine, Jim. And we should note there was just a meeting in Washington in which the Ukrainian president had his first meeting with President Biden. And Biden, made strong assertions of support for Ukrainian sovereignty, and there was a U.S. military aid package announced and so forth. So you have this sense of both countries, Russia and Belarus, feeling pressured by the West and feeling defiant and wanting to make some common cause.
And should we read anything, Bob, into the fact that the military exercises involving the Russian army and the Belarusian army are taking place near the Black Sea? Because when I look at the map of the world, I notice that Belarus doesn't border the Black Sea. Indeed, there's another country between Belarus and the Black Sea. It's called Ukraine. Are these military exercises about more than improving the professionalism of the Belarusian army?
That's certainly what's being conjectured and what's in the air, Jim, literally and figuratively. And there was still a great deal of concern about a Russian buildup this past spring near the Ukrainian border, which looked to some like preparations for a Russian move to strengthen its support and its own position vis-a-vis eastern Ukraine. Again, there are large chunks of eastern Ukraine, Russian-speaking areas, Russian-sympathetic areas, that it remains unresolved. Russia is nominally supposed to be in support of a diplomatic process that will allow some sort of self-rule in this area, but not any sort of annexation by Russia. So there's a great deal of concern that Russia is sort of saber-rattling in the region to show its capabilities and to threaten Ukraine and make Ukraine understand that it is in a weaker position and so forth. So there's a lot of concern about that kind of messaging, but also what does Belarus bring to the table in terms of its support for Russia, in terms of what it might be willing to do against Ukraine? That's a whole new area, Jim. I'm not sure where that stands.
Well, Bob, since we've mentioned Ukraine, I'm reminded that last week you and Carla Ann Robbins talked a little bit about Ukraine President Zelensky's visit to Washington. Anything notable come out of that might relate to or concern the Kremlin?
I think it was generally the fact of the meeting itself, from what I've seen, drew concern from like the Russian Foreign Ministry, for example. And, again, the assertions of support for Ukraine and sovereignty and statements about Russian aggressiveness in the region are not welcomed. There was no sign that I saw of any sort of pathway toward the NATO map, the membership action plan that Ukraine really wants. It continues to be a bit of a non-starter with the Biden administration. But again, the meeting did take place in the midst of a really turbulent week for U.S. policymakers still dealing with the aftermath of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. They postponed the Ukrainian meeting a couple of days, but they still held it. They realized the importance of it. There are a lot of people in the broader policy community who stress the importance of U.S. backing Ukraine. And I'm talking about both Republican and Democratic lawmakers who are strongly in favor of that. And it should be noted that even as President Trump was certainly more open towards having talks with Vladimir Putin, he did not ease up on sanctions against Russia. And part of that is because of the Republican foreign policy establishment, especially Republican lawmakers, supported that.
Well, I'm sure that President Putin will find a way to reference the meeting between Zelensky and Biden, either directly or indirectly, when he wraps up his meeting with Belarusian President Lukashenko.
I think there's a good bet that'll happen, Jim. I want to stay in the region, move a little bit west to an important country in the center of Europe. That would be Germany. And Germany has got elections coming up soon. It's a pivotal moment for the country for a lot of reasons, but let's start with the departure of Chancellor Angela Merkel. She's been 16 years in office. The election is going to involve the Greens, the Christian Democrats, and the Social Democrats in terms of what polls are indicating in terms of party support. A headline in the German newspaper Die Welt recently asked, is this the most boring election ever? So Jim, could you start by setting the scene for this election and what's at stake in the race?
Well, Bob, I should say that boredom is a label that is slapped on a lot of German elections, and that's because German elections typically are fairly predictable. But I think Die Welt is really missing the drama that's happening right under its own nose. I mean, Germany's election season so far has been fascinating to watch. Now, 2021 is what the Germans call a Superwahljahr, or super election year. My apologies to my grandmother for mangling that word. And what it means is that Germany is holding not just a national election, which is 3 weeks away this Sunday, but also about a half dozen regional or state elections. And as you mentioned, this month's national election will determine who is going to succeed Angela Merkel as chancellor. Now, she has dominated German politics for 16 years. Now, the election campaign has been fascinating because the expectations of which party has the upper hand has changed repeatedly in recent months. Back in the spring, the talk was that Merkel's party, the Christian Democratic Union, which is joined with the Christian Socialist Union of Bavaria, which is a senior partner in the current German coalition, was struggling. The CDU fared poorly in two state elections and had a bruising and divisive leadership battle. Meanwhile, the Social Democrats, the SPD, which is a junior partner in the current government, was doing even worse. So much so, there was even talk about its demise. And the star in the spring was the Green Party and its leader, Annalena Baerbock. She was being talked up as a possible chancellor, even though she had never served in government. Now, all of a sudden, we get to the summer and the Christian Democrats surge in the polls. Their leader, Armin Laschet, had won a leadership battle. One would have thought the Greens would have done well at the time, given the epic flooding that Germany experienced early in the summer dramatized the need to confront climate change. But Baerbock was hurt by charges that she had padded her resume and had plagiarized several passages in her campaign book on how to renew Germany. Germany. Now, in recent weeks, the Social Democrats have surged in the polls. This is the first time the SPD has led the CDU in the polls in, I think, 15 years. The leader of the SPD is Olaf Scholz, who is the current finance minister and vice chancellor. He was seen as the winner of last Sunday's debate. Meanwhile, Laschet has foundered, in part because of the divisions left over from the bruising leadership battle, but also because of some awkward campaign comments he's made. And also, he was caught laughing inappropriately while visiting one of the flood sites earlier this summer. Now, I should sort of point out that as you look at the polls, I think what is clear is that no party is running away with this election. The polls that show the Social Democrats ahead have the Social Democrats at just 24% in the polls. So that means that the expectations are very high that we are headed for a coalition government. No party is going to win a majority or come even close. And that is going to lead to some very interesting politicking that is going to happen in the wake of the vote count. And there are lots of different permutations of how the coalition could be formed. You mentioned, Bob, the three leading parties in the polls, but they're not the only parties in the poll. Another potential coalition partner are the Free Democrats, who have been in governments in a minority position in the past. So a lot to look forward to and a lot to try to game out when we're talking about Germany.
You're mentioning the way this has flowed, Jim, and you're right. It's fascinating. It's hard to remember a German election season where you had so many sort of shifts and pivots. It does show the importance, among other things, of the debate process in Germany, and also the kind of human character process. Germany's had a problem in recent years of leading figures padding resume or being suspected of doing so. So that's an interesting subplot. But I'm wondering about the bigger issues playing through here. You know, I mentioned the Nord Stream previously as a big energy deal that Germans have obviously been behind. I'm not sure if that's a divisive issue or not. But are there issues that are troubling Germans, whether related to COVID or sort of Germany's place in the world without Angela Merkel there at the helm that are sort of causing this upheaval in polls, at least?
Well, there are, Bob. I mean, I think if you look at Germany, as is the case, most countries around the world have been hurt by the recession triggered by COVID. My understanding is the German economy contracted something on the order of 5% over the past year. That's significant. Remember, Germany is the largest economy in Europe. It is seen merely as the engine that pulls along much of the rest of the European Union. But you also have issues over what German foreign policy should be, how close it should be allied to the United States, whether it should follow the United States' lead in looking askance at China and taking a more wary approach. And the parties take different positions on these issues. And this is why the outcome of the election and what kind of coalition forms is so important. Just to give you an example, if you were to get a coalition to come out of the elections that put the Green Party and the Social Democrats in control, you're likely to see a Germany that's going to spend more, maybe tougher on business, and given the inclinations of the Green Party, more eager to take on or challenge China. The Green Party has been very critical of China, both because of its failure to do more on climate change, but also because the Green Party has put values, democracy, human rights at the forefront. Meanwhile, if the CDU should manage to pull it out, cement its lead, you're likely to see a government that is less inclined to follow the Biden administration's lead on taking a tougher line on China. CDU basically more business-oriented on that score, trying to do the best by German businesses. Keep in mind, German manufacturers sell a lot of goods to China. I believe, actually, Germany is one of the few countries that has generally run a trade surplus with China. So there are a bunch of issues sort of floating around there. But I think in Germany, you can see signs of what you see in many other countries, which is an electorate that's not sure its government is capable of delivering on its promises. And indeed, I think the failure of the German government to anticipate and respond to the epic flooding that the country experienced earlier this year, troubles dealing with COVID, have raised those concerns about an inability of the government to stay on top of problems.
Jim, one party that hasn't gotten a lot of mention previously is the far-right Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD. And one of their big issues, obviously, is migration and sort of blood and soil nationalism. Is there a subtext to that percolating in this campaign that we should be noting? Because there's been so much populism in Europe over this issue.
That's a really good question, Bob. And it reminds me to make a point. As we sort of try to game out what's going to happen in the German elections, we rely very heavily on what the polls are telling us. And anytime we talk about polls, we probably should put a big asterisk over it, which is that polls can be wrong. Not saying that German pollsters are doing a bad job, but we have to be aware of that. Right now, the polls don't show Alternative for Germany being a major player in the election. It is quite clear that regardless of how the AfD does, it is not going to be in a coalition government. None of the major parties want anything to do with it. But again, you could have at the last moment a surge in support for, you know, Alternative for Germany, because we've seen in other countries where polls can underestimate the popularity of these right-wing parties. So again, everything depends at the end on who turns out and how they cast their votes. But I wouldn't expect that right-wing populism to dominate the coalition formation that you're going to see in Germany.
And back to one of the original parts of this conversation, we're in a new world with Germany in the absence of Angela Merkel.
Certainly, Bob. And I think that's going to be very important for the Biden administration, because much of what the Biden administration wants to do abroad requires getting cooperation from others. And if leading countries like Germany aren't interested in pursuing the same kind of policies, or because of their own internal politics and the complexity of a coalition, can't act, that is going to greatly hamstring a Biden foreign policy, as if the Biden White House doesn't have enough problems in its inbox at this time. But let's switch gears, Bob, and bring the discussion back home here to North America and talk about the upcoming meeting between the United States and Mexico. The Biden administration is about to relaunch a high-level economic dialogue, goes by the inelegant acronym of HLED, with the government of President López Obrador. The talks are going to be held next Thursday in Washington, and they will likely expand upon the virtual meeting that President Biden and President López Obrador had back in March. So set the table for us, Bob, on these talks.
Well, I should note, first of all, Jim, that since that virtual meeting, there were also subsequent high-level talks in person that included Kamala Harris in Mexico. I think it was one of her first big trips abroad. And they definitely talked about setting up this dialogue. That was, I think, late spring, early summer. And then just last month, there was a pretty big mission from the U.S. visiting Mexico that included Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, and Homeland Security Chief, to talk about a whole range of issues, economic, but also a bit of security, indicating that there's going to be some security aspects to this discussion. But this meeting last month, according to the White House readout, was pretty much a setup meeting for the high-level economic dialogue in Washington. To read from the readout, basically, they talked about integrating the economies. There's another integration term again, to make them more resilient and to, quote, strengthen supply chains in alignment with our domestic efforts to build back better, end quote. That's a term, obviously, the Biden administration is using quite a bit in its economic development language and messaging. I think what you're going to hear a lot about, Jim, and our colleague Shannon O'Neill has talked about this, is the degree to which the U.S. and Mexico can further strengthen supply chains. In the case of Mexico, maybe stepping in place where some Asian countries, and especially China, were involved in supply chain. And in so doing, sort of remove some of the insecurity that the COVID-19 pandemic created in terms of the slowdown and the logjam in global supply chains. So I think that's going to be really an important feature of these talks, which are going to involve high-level cabinet officials or cabinet ministers, I should say, from the economic finance fields in both countries. And then they're going to be talking about irregular migration, a gigantic issue between the two countries as the U.S. has dealt with record migration flows from Mexico in recent months. And also, trying to regionalize migration, which was part of Kamala Harris's, the purpose of her trip, dealing with the Northern Triangle countries in Central America, trying to keep the migration limited to those countries so they're not going to transit Mexico and add to the hundreds of thousands who've tried to come into the United States. So I think those are a couple of really huge issues, just supply chains and migration in and of themselves, Jim.
Oh, I agree, Bob. Those are both very big issues. I'm left wondering, though, how much progress can be made in a dialogue like this. Let's just take the supply chain issue first. What is it the Biden administration administration could do that would meaningfully alter the nature of supply chains because they're driven largely by economic incentives, market incentives. You could imagine passing laws that could change that, but that requires Congress to come along, and Congress isn't going to have a seat at the table for the HLED. So what precisely would be happening or could be promised at such a meeting that would make a discernible difference in how supply chains operate?
It's a really good question. I have not seen the nitty-gritty on that, Jim, but I would say that U.S. officials have repeatedly been noting that a feature of the talks will be to highlight U.S. investment in southern Mexico. And this is going to involve grants, loans, and other sorts of arrangements in the neighborhood of $250 million in new investment and sales in southern Mexico. And so I think they are going to try to help the rural regions of that part of the country, which is a part of the country that's typically the poorest in Mexico. It's also the area where you're getting a lot of migrants who are transiting it on top of everything. So I think it's an attempt to try to strengthen a part of Mexico that is seen as a weak link in the country and the country's ability to develop and strengthen its own supply chains, and also to potentially deal with irregular, you know, migration flows and so forth. I think you're probably going to hear a lot more about, you know, say technical assistance and then things like COVID relief, which is a combination of things. Mexico has struggled, like many countries, Mexico has struggled with multiple surges of COVID. But one of the areas the U.S. can definitely help in, and they've had some recent announcements, is in vaccines and sort of ramping up the vaccines, especially the Moderna and the Pfizer varieties, the two-shot vaccines from both of those. And potentially as part of that, improving Mexico's ability not only to cope with the virus, but to be a help in the supply chain, including even in medical areas. But I think the details are still to emerge on this, Jim, because I have not seen anything sort of granular about what it means to have Mexico stepping in, especially in replacing China, which has been such a gigantic part. We should also note, though, these are two countries that have that are part of a major North American trade agreement. It was rewritten and rejiggered in some ways under the Trump administration, but it's still a big deal, especially in the production of cars. There's going to be more and more efforts to try to transition to electric cars as part of the manufacturing that is going to take place primarily in Mexico. So a number of different fronts there, Jim.
So I take the point that on the supply chain side of the equation, what the United States may be doing is less offering things to the Mexicans as opposed to trying to persuade the Mexican government to make it easier for Americans to invest, particularly in southern Mexico. But on the other big question on immigration, given how much immigration has dominated American politics in recent years and how much it has bedeviled the Biden administration since it first came into office back in January, what's on the immigration agenda that Washington and Mexico City haven't already talked to death?
That is probably one of the biggest questions that a lot of lawmakers in Washington are going to be especially interested in. And it's why in the meeting last month in Mexico, you had, along with the National Security Advisor, the Homeland Security Director Mayorkas attending. You had the Undersecretary of State as well. The messaging that's coming out on that, Jim, is that they are trying to come up with a way to manage migration, certainly better than it has before. I'm not sure if there's going to be any new approaches that come out and potentially variations on the Remain in Mexico policy that the Trump administration hammered out could be in the offing, at least initially, because the numbers are so large and the U.S. capacity to process the numbers, the strain it takes, especially when you have children involved, you have families involved, all happening under COVID and the concerns about maintaining some sort of orderly flow amidst COVID, Jim, it's all adding up to a kind of a real tough issue. It's hard to imagine, to your question, what innovations might come out of this, but I do think it's going to be a doubling down to some degree on what Vice President Harris talked about in terms of trying to support the Northern Triangle countries more in helping them to make their situations better, whether it involves in crime, whether it involves combating corruption, so forth, and then helping Mexico to deal with what will still be flows of migrants coming through those countries.
So this meeting looks to be more ordinary diplomacy than breakthrough diplomacy.
Yes, I would say yes, Jim, but I would note that it has been something that both countries were intent on keeping, despite a whole host of other challenges on both of their agendas. So yes, it's a lot more of talking still going on, but we should look for some of the details, especially about what the U.S. is willing to invest in Mexico. On the migration front, though, it's hard to see what sort of innovations are going to come out of this.
Got it.
Jim, we have talked ourselves into the figure of the week part of the podcast, or should I say the audience figure of the week part. This is when listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. Jim, the audience this week chose the new Taliban head, Baradar. So why do you think they chose him, Jim?
Well, I suspect our audience, which is a pretty smart audience, chose Baradar because with the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan now complete, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar is now responsible for running the country. Now, for the purists out there, I have to point out that technically he is not the leader of the Taliban. That role is held by the Taliban's supreme leader, Hibatullah Akhundzada, with Baradar's title being the senior deputy leader of the Taliban. But as a practical matter, he is the group's de facto leader in the face of the new government. Now, we don't know much about him or about how strong his hold is on power. He's believed to be about 53. Baradar is a nickname. It means brother. It was bestowed upon him by Mullah Omar, the original leader of the Taliban. The two men became friends when they were teenagers. Baradar held senior positions in the Afghan government when the Taliban ruled the country from 1996 to 2001. There are a lot of stories told about Baradar. He may or may not have been detained briefly by U.S. forces in the early days of the Afghanistan war, and he may or may not have saved Mullah Omar from capture by U.S. forces. What we do know for sure is that between 2004 and 2010, he was involved in several efforts to negotiate with the U.S.-backed Afghanistan government. Those efforts finally prompted the Pakistani government to arrest him, supposedly because they feared he was cutting a deal behind their back. Now, not surprisingly, Baradar is rumored not to be terribly fond of Pakistan's inter-service intelligence, the ISI, which has funded parts of the Taliban over the years. Now, Pakistan released Baradar in 2018 at the request of the United States government. The Trump administration was hoping that he would be willing to negotiate an end to the war. He certainly was willing to talk, but he didn't give up much as a negotiator. And so it was the Trump administration that conceded its way to an agreement. The challenge that Baradar now faces is to run a country of 38 million people, many of whom reject the Taliban's strict ideology. And he faces really daunting challenges in the short term and the long term. In the short term, the challenges are obvious. The economy is seized up. Banks and shops are closed. International aid, which accounted for almost half the country's GDP, has dried up, at least for now. The United States has frozen Afghanistan's reserves, and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have announced they will suspend aid. Western powers like Germany have done the same thing. So they have some very important and pressing short-term challenges. And when you look to the long term, you look at Afghanistan, it is a country that is being racked by COVID, and it's also facing climate change. I've seen studies suggesting that average temperatures in Afghanistan have gone up at twice the pace of the global average, and it is wreaking havoc on agriculture. And this is a country whose economy rests heavily on subsistence type agriculture. So there are real pressing problems. And it is now the responsibility of Mr. Baradar and his colleagues to try to negotiate a way out of the hole they find themselves.
Well, Jim, you've laid out a pretty daunting picture for anybody, even somebody like Angela Merkel, who we were just talking about, I would think would be hard put to deal with the situation. But Baradar, I think reading through the lines of what you were just talking about, there seems to be an element of pragmatism in his approach, at least to date, in dealing with outside parties. The question is whether some form of a Taliban government emerges from the talks that are going on. I think they're going on in Kandahar right now about what is the power structure in the country and then what is his role in there. And I think another thing that might be interesting to watch is that there initially has been sort of heading a transitional body, former chief executive Abdullah, as well as former president Hamid Karzai, who I think has had past involvement in negotiations with Baradar. So he's going to be hard put to kind of come up with a solution for the country, though.
Well, you're certainly right, Bob, about the short-term pragmatism of the Taliban. There have been a number of news stories talking about how the U.S. military work with elements of the Taliban to try to foil terrorist attacks by the ISIS groups based in Afghanistan. And again, the Taliban have a very strong incentive, at least in the near term, to try to present a new front to the rest of the world. Again, if you live in a country which depends heavily on international assistance, then you got to try to find ways to keep that assistance flowing. What we don't know is whether Baradar either personally wants to sustain that pragmatism for any prolonged period of time, or even if he does, whether he has the capacity to get get others in the Taliban government to go along. And as you know, we still don't even really know what the Taliban government or the new government of Afghanistan is going to look like and to what extent it will get support and loyalty from the disparate groups around the country, speaking in terms both of ethnicity, but also in terms of clan and the like. But I should say there's also a flip problem for the United States, Bob, and that is to what extent should the United States use economic coercion against the Taliban, either in practice or as a threat? Because obviously, the United States has a concern about the condition of the Afghan people, but it also has to worry about compounding Afghanistan's problems, which could create bigger openings for the very terrorist groups to flourish. And again, we originally went into Afghanistan to prevent those terrorist groups from operating. So there are going to be some very tough decisions, not just for the Taliban to make, but also for the United States and other countries who are greatly concerned about what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan.
No, it's a really good point. I mean, I think as the last U.S. troops left this week from Afghanistan after 20 years, there were the statements, it's now about the diplomacy. Well, this is going to take all the diplomatic skill that there is to muster to try to sort of work out something that's workable for the greater good of Afghan people, given everything that's just happened to them and to the leadership of their country, Jim. And it does also bring to mind what happened the last time the Taliban was isolated 20 years ago, just before 9/11. You know, they became more and more reliant on revenues from the opium drug trade, and opium is still a cash crop, in some ways doing better under climate change than it had been previously, but also being susceptible to jihadist forces that sought refuge in the country. And that was in those days Al-Qaeda. Now there's reports of all sorts of groups, including ISIS and ISIS affiliate and so forth.
I suspect that Afghanistan is going to be in the news for quite a while yet to come.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. A G20 health ministers meeting takes place in Rome. Morocco holds general elections, and Pakistan's army chief is set to deliver an address on Defense Day.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you as always, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.